I'm Jessica Reeves, and I've been analyzing and reporting on extremism for the last 10 years, and I have the gray hair to prove it. Subscribe to our podcast, Extremely, for an always eye-opening look inside the daily work of exposing, fighting, and disrupting all facets of extremism. My co-host, Oren Siegel, and I explore this ever-changing landscape and bring you stories of people and places impacted by extremism, those who fight to protect our communities, and those who offer new perspectives. You can find Extremely wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Hi, I'm Anna Marie Cox, and welcome to With Friends Like These. The show, well, what I usually say here is that we talk about the differences between us without letting them divide us. And that is what the show tries to do. But it's hard. It's hard because apparently it's human nature to seek divisions. Or it's the nature of some kinds of humans. I don't know. To sort of explain why I'm having a little bit of a problem with the concept of being able to talk about differences without divisions, I want to tell you a story. It is 1954. A social psychologist named Muzaffer Sherif and his colleagues decide they want to run an experiment in Oklahoma City. They gather up a group of boys. They are selected to be the same religion, the same age. They give them psychological tests to make sure they have the same basic like emotional makeup, the same educational background. They want to get the most homogeneous group of boys that they can. I imagine Oklahoma City wasn't too hard. So they take this really, really same group of boys, and they divide them into two groups, and they take them camping. They name one group the Eagles and the other group the Rattlers, and for a week, they do not tell them about each other. And then they do. And immediately, each group starts talking about the other group without having laid eyes on that other group. They start talking about the other group as outsiders and intruders. And they start to ask for some kind of competition between the two of them. They like are hungry for some sort of contest or clash. And so the experimenters, they organize a baseball tournament. And they come into contact for the very first time to play baseball. And they start calling each other names. Pigs, bums, cheaters. They don't know anything about each other. And they are reluctant to spend time with the other team when they get a chance. So even when they're sitting on the sidelines, they sit with their own groups. And after that game, I don't know who won it. That would probably be good to know, but I don't know who won it. And after that game, things deteriorate further. The Eagles, they burn the Rattlers' flag. The Rattlers raid the Eagles' cabin in the middle of the night. And then the Eagles raid the Rattlers' cabin. Things actually deteriorate into violence at one point when the boys are able to see each other. In fact, the experimenters decide to keep them physically separate from one another for the duration of the experiment in order to avoid possible injury. But the experiment continues, and it turns out that these boys' feelings about each other warp their reality. Stop me if that sounds a little familiar. They assign the boys this task of collecting beans, and then they flash the collections up on the screen, and each team looks at these groups of beans, these piles of beans, and tell the experimenters that their team collected the most, even though the experimenters have put up on the screen two identical piles of beans. Yes. This experiment has some bearing on today's politics, I think. That is the story that leads off Lillian Mason's uncivil agreement, how politics became our identity. She is our guest this week.
So I want to welcome to the show Lillianna Mason. She's the author of Uncivil Agreement, How Politics Became Our Identity. She is an assistant professor of government politics at the University of Maryland.
I am excited to talk to you because I have kind of a follow-up question on the whole robber's cave experiment and the idea that it translates pretty well to American politics today. Those two groups were, you know, identical in terms of how much power and privilege they had. And I'm really curious about what happens when power and privilege aren't divided equally. Like, oh, just for instance, let's say that, you know, one group controls all three branches of government and the other group does not. And one group has a lot of rich people in it and one group does not. And yet it's the group with the three branches of government and a lot of the wealthy people who says that they are the ones under attack. Can you help explain why that is?
One of the things that I find is that people are really, you know, we connect our own status, our own individual status to the status of our groups and the groups that we belong to. And so if you're in a group that has traditionally high status, and that includes white people, straight people, you know, cis people, any group that is generally considered, you know, just like a, what people I think would sometimes call just like a regular person. There's a sense that there's like a baseline person. And in fact, I've been, you know, I've had an older white gentleman argue with me and tell me that I have an identity because I'm a woman, but he has no identity. So there's this sense, right, that there's this baseline identity, this baseline person that has no identity whatsoever. But of course we all have identity. And those of us who have identities that are traditionally higher status and not marginalized, we really tend to cling to those identities because they make us feel good. Especially if we don't feel good about other things in our lives as individuals. And so if we feel like our privileged status is being threatened, you know, not even our safety or our way of life, just, you know, am I still the most, you know, the most powerful group in the country? That is a threat that feels really, really uncomfortable. And so people tend to respond to that, particularly people in traditionally high status groups tend to respond to that with a lot of aversion. And they're in groups that are, you know, that feel they're relatively, insulated, that feel like they are, you know, part of this long, you know, long tradition of, you know, this is often, you know, one of those things where people talk about this being a Christian nation. And so, you know, there is this sense that religiosity or Christianity is part of, makes you part of this very special group of people who started the whole country. Mm. And if, you know, if you're going to be on the same level as these other people who aren't part of your group and have traditionally been shunned, have been considered to be outsiders to the extent that it's been okay to make fun of them and to be violent against them. That's a real threat. It doesn't feel good. It makes people tend to, you know, react strongly against it. And I think it's, you know, it's completely possible for people to rationally think, you know, I just think that you've moved too fast. But really psychologically be motivated by this sense of like, I don't like how this feels.
Yeah. And I guess that brings up a question as far as the, I didn't think I was a Nazi till you called me a Nazi argument, which is being called a bigot a status threat? Is that why people would react that way?
No, it's a really interesting question to ask right now. Because of, you know, this whole, we've got people wearing T-shirts that say deplorable. And so, but even that, I think, is a response to a sense that it is an insult. It's an insult to be called a racist. It's an insult to be called a bigot or deplorable. And so when, you know, we have norms, we have social norms that generally prohibit us from using that type of language, at least in, you know, the larger public, right? Like on television and, you know, in the media, you know, remember, like George Allen said the word macaca and his entire campaign was destroyed, right?
Oh, so there has been this sense
that there's, you know, there are real, you know, it's really bad to be called a racist and it's an insult. And so one way to deal with that is to say, how dare you, you know, call me that? I'm not one. But possibly an even stronger way to respond to it is to say, particularly if you are, you know, in one of these traditionally high status groups, so if you're white or male or Christian, it's easy to say, no, I'm actually, you know, one of the most powerful groups in this country. I have historically been a member of one of the most powerful groups in this country. How dare you call me that? And therefore, since you think it's so bad, then why don't I just, you know, hold on to this white identity as hard as I can, for instance. Yeah. But it does require someone to actually really feel strongly identified as white to begin with, right? Not everyone is going to respond that way to being called racist.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people who are not strongly identified as white, you know, white people who are not strongly identified as white would not respond that way. And also, generally, people who are non-white are not going to respond that way because it's, you know, the status differential is really meaningful.
Now, if we can just go back to Robber's Cave for a second, and I realize this is not like perfect analogy and everything, but another question that has to do with those two groups' homogeneity, which is, I feel like one lesson out of Robber's Cave is not about how we all tend to divide up and compete with each other when given a chance, but how straight white men divide up and compete with each other when they get a chance. I'm wondering, do groups of non-privileged people go to war with each other in the same way that two groups of, you know, statistically similarly privileged people do?
That's a really interesting question. I haven't actually thought about it. I mean, my first thought would be that it would depend entirely on the context. So if you know, so the Robber's Cave experiment was done in, you know, a park outside of Oklahoma City in the 1950s, and it was all fifth grade boys. So like, keep in mind, right? These were fifth grade boys.
Right.
But we all do tend to kind of conform to this behavior that they were observed to have. So if they had not all been white, Protestant, you know, relatively, you know, scholastically capable, from the same type of family structure, if instead, you know, this had been a group of, you know, Black children in the 1950s, I'm guessing that there wouldn't have been the same type of fight in the sense that everyone around that campsite would have been white.
Mm-hmm.
So, right. So in the world in which the Robber's Cave experiment happened, these were a bunch of white Protestant boys in a white Protestant world. So for them, being the best meant just being the best, you know, fifth grade boy.
Right.
So the idea of status threat was not coming from anywhere else. It was only coming from the fact that there was another camp of boys down the road. For a different group, you know, especially for a marginalized group, you would, you know, depending on who the counselors were, right? How they got there, who they see every day. If it was a camp for all, you know, all Black children that like took care of them and was, you know, allowed them to just be themselves, I'm not sure they would have competed at all. They might have actually just thought it was a really great place to, go to camp.
Because I was thinking about how, you know, we usually, I think, a fairly natural assumption, I want to be careful how I use this language, but I think it would be easy to assume that conflicts, you know, erupt out of a crisis of resources, right? That's what we fight over. That's in privilege, maybe even as a kind of resource, right? And you fight because you want to be the best. But I agree that when I think about what it might have looked like to have two groups of girls, you know, or two groups of Black children, I think that though they would be marginalized in society at large, they probably wouldn't have had that same, like, let's just go ahead and call it a pissing contest, right? Or a dick measuring contest that these two groups of boys. I don't want to extrapolate too much on that, but I am interested in your research because one of the things that also turns up in your research is that, you know, we have collapsed identity and partisanship, right?
Right.
It occurs to me that's easy to do if you're one of the base, what we, you know, very heteronormatively and racistly think of as the regular person, mm-hmm. right? If you're not a regular person, it's harder to collapse that identity. If you're not white man, right. cis, is that what you found?
Yeah. So that's where I actually find the differences between Republicans and Democrats. And it's something that I've actually kind of, I'm sort of moving into it now more with my research after the book. I don't talk a lot about party asymmetry in the book, but it is sort of implied in that the real difference between Republicans and Democrats is that we have, you know, Republicans essentially have become the party of, white Christian maybe men, but although that's gender is a strange identity, and then Democrats are the party of everyone else, right? Not white, not Christian, and so essentially what we end up with is one party that is really truly homogeneous, the Republican Party, and then the Democratic Party is they're very clearly socially distinct from Republicans, but they're not necessarily they're not in a group that's homogeneous because non-white is not an identity. Right. And in fact, you know, 55% of Democrats are white and over half of Democrats are also Christian. So what ends up happening within the Democratic Party is that everybody has the same identity as being a Democrat. But they also have to work together with people outside of their racial group and outside of their religious group relatively often under the party umbrella. For Republicans, it's very less common for someone in the Republican Party to have to work together under the Republican Party umbrella with someone who is racially or religiously different from them. You know, there's obviously a few cases, but it is much, much less common in the Republican Party. And I think of that as sort of one way to understand sort of what's going on with our politics, in that generally, if you have, this is something that social psychologists have studied for a long time. If you have, you know, two different identities that are largely overlapping, by which I mean most of the people in one group are also members of the other group, you tend to be more intolerant of outsiders. It's this finding that's been replicated a few times. And if you have really sort of not overlapping groups, so, you know, very few people who are in one of your groups are also in another group, then you tend to be more tolerant of outsiders. One of the classic examples is, women CEOs. So if you identify as a woman and you identify as a CEO, those are not largely overlapping groups. And so you'll think of people who are not women and not exactly right. Not yet. But it's a lot easier to think about people who are not women and not CEOs as people who are like you because you meet them in, you know, one of your groups.
Right.
But if you're a male CEO, then you're not necessarily, you know, coming across a whole lot of women. And you're not necessarily, you know, you're probably hanging out with a lot of, you know, high powered business people. And so it's a lot easier to just sort of think of people who are not in your group as someone you don't really need to know, someone you don't need to think about, and someone who isn't you know, in the most benevolent side, who isn't on your radar?
Right.
And in the sort of the most dangerous side, as somebody who you actually actively want to harm. And that's sort of what we've seen happen over the last few decades for the two parties.
It reminds me of something I discovered when I was doing research into kind of the different outcomes for implicit bias training versus just trying to be a more diverse organization. And it turns out that the diversity efforts are relatively like long lasting and concrete, whereas implicit bias efforts, not so much. Because I think with the study I saw, I think more than once, showed that if you make an effort to just say like that target race diversity, you wind up increasing diversity in all kinds of other areas too. Just, and I think it's because of what you're talking about, because like once you start hiring people who are not straight white men, their eyes are open to all kinds of people as potential colleagues. And so you just wind up getting more different people in the mix because of the sort of the phenomenon you're talking about.
Yeah, no. And in fact, if you just think about it in terms of, you know, this basic theory of if your groups are overlapping, right, as soon as you introduce one extra group into the office, assuming that people have an identity as being, you know, part of that office, which generally people do, you know, we have a million identities, right? Mm-hmm. You can identify as almost anything. And so as long as, you know, you have a sort of a new ingredient that's part of your office group identity, that should immediately make you think about, well, what other, you know, what other people are out there?
Mm-hmm.
How can we, you know, like this, all of a sudden it moves from this very insulated homogeneous group of people into a slightly less homogeneous group of people, which psychologically should increase tolerance for outgroups in general.
What is texture? Great question. Texture is the surface of things, and Texture is the magazine app. It offers more than 200 of the best magazines all in one place. Get complete issues, get back issues, anytime, anywhere, all in one place. Stay connected to the biggest and best stories with Texture. You can stay connected to political stuff, of course. They have Time, they have The Atlantic, they have The New Yorker. You can also do things like research, just for instance, a home renovation project, which is what I've used it for. You know, the latest issues of design magazines may not have what you're looking for, but somewhere in the archives, they're going to have your dream bathroom, your dream kitchen, your dream bedroom, whatever. We're redoing our bathroom. I'll probably mention that again at some point because it's going to take a while. Anyway, Texture is a great place for me to go and remind myself about why I'm putting myself and my family through this trouble. To get your free trial of Texture, a 7-day free trial, please go to texture.com/friends. Again, that's texture.com/friends. Why wait to start reading the latest issues of your favorite magazines or your soon to be favorite magazines? Try Texture for free today at texture.com/friends. That's texture.com/friends and start your free trial. Journalist Mehdi Hasan is known around the world for his televised takedowns of presidents and prime ministers. He hosts Upfront on Al Jazeera and is a columnist for The Intercept. And in his new podcast, Deconstructed, Mehdi unpacks a game-changing news event of the week while challenging the conventional wisdom in a tight 30-minute package, a little quicker than what we do here. He starts his show with his take on one topic and what the mainstream news is getting wrong or what context is being missed. And then he goes into a deep analysis in conversation with his guest or guests of the week. And get this, his guests have included Judd Apatow, Bernie Sanders, and Hasan Minhaj. So he kind of covers the gamut, I would say, in terms of who you might be expecting. It's everyone from comedians to politicians to, for instance, Stefan Clark's fiance. So you're going to hear from a lot of different people. And the show has covered such topics as the violence in Gaza from the perspective of Israeli activists against the occupation and, of course, police shootings as through the eyes of the fiance of Stefan Clark. Also, he's talked about the dangers of John Bolton with former diplomats. As a Brit and a Muslim and immigrant based in Donald Trump's Washington, D.C., Mehdi Hasan gives a refreshingly provocative perspective on the ups and downs of American and global politics. Deconstructed is a show that cuts through political drivel and media misinformation to give you a straight take on one big news story of the week. It is out every Friday, just like this pod. You can listen and subscribe at theintercept.com/deconstructed or on any podcast platform.
I look forward to, I guess, your next book already, because one thing in your book that I had to keep kind of catching myself on, because I think when you talk about parties and stuff, you pretty much talk about parties and you don't do a lot of like, it's different with this particular ideology versus that particular ideology. Like, you're majorly talking about like partisanship just as an idea. So there was a part of me that was like, do my people, I go ahead and I identify as a progressive liberal person, act the same way? And you're from, but what I hear you saying is that there are some differences because of those overlapping identities, that you can't kind of do, you know, both siderism, right? Like, there is something very different about how these two groups of people, at least in America, the way that our parties now exist, they react differently.
Yeah. So I want to say that, you know, the first sort of overall caution to be offered with this is that every single person is equally vulnerable.
Yes.
To doing this. And you're right. What we've ended up with is this particular arrangement of party and social identity, where, you know, one party is essentially representing the traditionally high status groups of people, and the other party is representing everybody else. And so, you know, if any of that were to change, then you know, all of this could change. It's not necessarily that Republicans are always going to be like this. Mm. Or even that conservatives are always going to be like this. It's just that, or that Democrats can't be. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, every single person who calls himself a liberal or progressive absolutely can have this happen to them. But the way that we're situated right now, and this is actually something. I mean, this is George Washington warned about this in his farewell speech in 1796 or something. He actually specifically said, you know, if you end up getting into factions that are too separate from each other, you invite not just corruption, but foreign influence. He specifically said you invite foreign influence.
Oh, God, he was warning us about Russia. George Washington.
He's specifically, yeah. He was saying, if you...
he was warning us about the 2016 election. Weird. That's so crazy.
It's a really bizarre quote to read. It's kind of, I mean, you should just read that entire speech. It's pretty short. It's really fascinating. Because one of the things he was saying is, if you guys start fighting against each other, you're going to forget that our nation is the most important thing to defend. Mm-hmm. And if you forget that, we are vulnerable. So we need to make sure going forward that, you know, he hated the idea of parties. He did not want us to turn into a partisan nation. Obviously, we had already done so at that point, but he didn't like it. And the reason that he didn't like it was this idea that when you start feeling like your fellow citizens are your enemy, then you lose track of what your enemies are doing, what your real enemies are doing. And, you know, we got to this point where, you know, we're saying, you know, I'd rather, like in Alabama, right, where we were saying, like, I would rather have a child molester as my senator than a Democrat. Mm-hmm. And once you get to that point, you have to kind of sit back and think about what are we actually one nation right now? And how can we try to reduce this? Because it's getting to the point now where it is really dangerous, and it's sort of blinding to a lot of people.
Okay, Professor, what can we do?
that's a really good question. So I almost titled the concluding chapter of my book 10 Unlikely Scenarios, because I can think of a few things, but I'm not sure how any of them happen. So one is a major realignment. This is sort of how it started, right? Is that the Southern Democrats, the racially conservative Southern Democrats left the Democratic Party after the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But they didn't leave right away, because partisanship is really strong. It's a really strong identity. And in the South, in the, you know, 50s and 60s, the idea of being Republican was repugnant to people. And so a lot of these Southern Democrats refused to call themselves Republicans.
But yellow dog Democrats. They were yellow. That's where the term yellow dog Democrat comes from.
Right, right. They started sometimes voting for Republicans. And maybe after, you know, years, they started to call themselves independents. But it's such a strong identity that really it took a generation, you know. So maybe they're calling themselves independents, and then their children grow up feeling like maybe I can move from independent to Republican. And so that's part of the reason that it's been so many decades that it's taken us to get to here is because, you know, we started this process in the 60s, and then partisanship is so strong that it took us, you know, 50 years to get to a place where we're kind of realigned into the new, quote unquote, correct groups, the groups that match our racial and religious identities. And so we could see something like that again. One of the barriers to that is that it seems to require an identity that's stronger than party to break up party identity. And race is one of those. And that's, you know, that certainly worked in the 60s. I don't know if we're going to see, you know, some sort of break between, you know, racially moderate Republicans and racially conservative Republicans. That's what people were predicting before Trump was elected or just after Trump was elected, but it doesn't seem to be happening. Mm-hmm. So there could be some, you know, in some way, a partisan realignment that would take a few decades. And in between, we would have all these cross-cutting identities. People wouldn't know exactly who they're supposed to vote for, and we would have less polarization. So,
and what you mean by racially,
I'm not sure how that happens.
Moderate versus not racially moderate. You mean like, I will say,
like the racist and not racist.
Yes. Okay, I'll go ahead and put out there. And it was predicted that
I'm using the academic term. Yeah,
the racist would leave the Republican Party, but it turns out either people are you know, more racially intolerant than we realized, or they're other identity is stronger, right? Like it's so important right. to them. For instance, we can talk about, you know, my co-religionists again, the conservative white evangelicals who may, you know, have lots of love in their hearts for all kinds of people, but they are so focused on a few issues that Trump champions, they're like, but I can't let go. And so whatever other identity they have, even if one of their identities is not being a racist, they still haven't left the party. So, okay.
Well, they can't vote for a Democrat.
Right.
I think, right?
Exactly.
It's you could be uncomfortable with what's going on, but you could never imagine yourself voting for a Democrat.
Right. Right.
Which, to be honest, I think a lot of the Southern Democrats in the 60s probably felt that way. They were really strongly identified as Democrat, and they couldn't imagine identifying as Republican.
I should actually, for people that don't know the term yellow dog Democrat, that does mean I'd rather vote for a yellow dog than for a Republican. I'd vote for a yellow dog who was a Democrat before I would vote for a Republican. And then my family proudly called itself yellow dog Democrats for a long time until I did not realize that term was actually hugely racist in its own
wow.
way. I mean, it has a racist history.
Yeah.
In that why people would vote for a Democrat. So we don't use that term in my family anymore. But yes.
I mean, this could happen, right? It could gradually over time, we could see. And it's not necessarily that the racists would leave the Republican Party, but maybe they would stay. And the, you know, people who are uncomfortable with overt racism and white supremacy would, you know, start voting with Democrats every once in a while, and then this gradual shift could occur. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that's a possibility. Although then we could end up with, you know, a party of white supremacy and then a party of everyone else, which would not necessarily be good for polarization either.
No, or good. Just, it would not be good. I would
or
go
just
with,
good. Yeah, not good. It's not good.
I think we already have a running experiment on that, to be honest. So, and it's turned out not good.
We kind of do.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, we kind of do. At least in terms of the people who are speaking out loud.
Yeah.
The another thing that could happen is that, so in the Robbers Cave experiment, right, the boys hated each other. They refused to even get in the same bus to go home at the end of camp. And so the counselors did a whole bunch of exercises where the two teams had to work together in order to solve the problem. And after doing these exercises, like one of them was like, the water system to the camp was turned off and they had no water and they had to all go fix it. There was like a tree that had fallen over and they had to go fix it together. And so they did these exercises working together for the good of the whole, of all the boys. And then they, at the end, they still hated each other, but they got on the bus together. They agreed to get on the bus together. So, and this is like the Independence Day scenario, right?
Right.
Aliens invade the planet.
Is that the academic term for it?
Yeah, that's my academic term for it. Aliens invade the planet, and then we all realize we're all human and we band together, right? But the problem with this idea is it's the idea of a superordinate identity. Mm-hmm. And the problem with the idea of a superordinate identity is that we have to, you know, both sides are going to have to agree that the threat is the same and that the solution to the threat is the same. And if they don't, then we become even more polarized. So, for instance, after 9/11, right, Bush had approval numbers in the 90%. The whole country was together, and then as soon as the Iraq War, solution
as soon as
was,
I mean,
on
that
the
was,
table,
it took 2 years, and there was a big argument about it. And yes, right, but yes. Yes.
Right. Right. And that solution polarized people,
yeah,
right? Because because half the country really didn't think that was a good idea. And so, you know, there is a threat. And then if you can't agree on how to fix it, then it doesn't work. It's not a unifying thing. So that is one way to do it. Another way would be to try, this is also really hard, to think about a media that doesn't present everything as a horse race. So, you know, when there's legislation going through Congress on, gun control, don't discuss it as a victory for Democrats if this passes, right? Instead, it's like, this is something that a lot of Americans really think is important. And, you know, is there enough support in Congress for this? And so, because the way that every piece of legislation now is discussed, it's like, well, it's a win for Democrats or it's a win for Republicans, or it's a win for Trump or it's not a win for Trump. And that I actually just have I wrote an op-ed just today about how this, like, Trump using the word winning over and over again is really damaging. And it really focuses everybody's attention on the victory itself and not on what we're actually doing after the victory happens. And there is policy. We need to be doing it. Like, we need to be legislating. We need to actually be governing. But when we're so invested in our identities, we tend to think about whether or not we're winning as more important than the actual outcomes of government. Mm-hmm. And that's another, like, psychological, you know, like, psychologists have been looking at this for a long time and demonstrated that when you identify with a group, you prefer the group to win over the greater good of everybody. And you're willing to essentially sacrifice your own resources in order to get the victory instead of everybody getting the best situation.
Well, this explains Trump's always shoot the hostage negotiating style.
Yeah, right, exactly. And it also explains, like, you know, sort of this language always about how, you know, or this sort of always going back to Hillary, right? Always going back to, you know, how big the crowds were, going back to the, you know, the number of electoral votes, the, you know, going, harping on the election itself really is just reinforcing, like, we won that. We are winners because of that. And it doesn't matter what happens. The analogy that I use is, like, after the Super Bowl, we don't ask the teams to do something else. Right? They just win. And then we're happy.
Right.
And so it's the trophy. The trophy is the goal. There's nothing else to be done after you get the trophy. And the more we focus on that as a central idea, the more I think it's impossible to find a way to govern, because everything is zero sum.
One thing that my show tries to get to is how we navigate this time. You know, how we interact with the people that have different identities than we do.
So one thing I actually would say in terms of, like, interacting with other people is that so much of, so, you know, when I say like legislation is this idea of zero sum, essentially all of our politics at this point is loaded with this idea of who wins and who loses. And so, you know, a lot of, at least my sense of a lot of the ways that we can talk, that we can kind of create more cross-cutting identities, or like create, understand people across the other, on the other side, is to stop talking about politics with them. right. Talk about their family. Talk about, right. Talk about like things you have in common. And then once you're, you know, actually engaged with each other on a human level, then you could maybe talk about politics. But to start off with it is, it immediately creates this, like, if you win, then I lose. And therefore this conversation, there's going to be absolutely no compromise in this conversation. So that's one, and that's, but that's a very individual level type thing. And it's also important to remember that because of the makeup of the Republican Party, there are more Democrats who are willing to do this than Republicans.
Yeah.
Democrats are much more used to reaching out to people that are not like them, because we have all these people in our party that are, you know, that are like Democrats, you know, that are also Democrats, but that are unlike the Democrats in racial and religious ways.
Right. Well, it's a diverse party. That's the what you're saying is that we're used to working with people who are different than us. So
that really forces people to practice talking to people who are not like them. And so a lot of this, you know, like looking out to the rural Trump voter in, you know, some random place that we keep doing is, you know, it's a really sort of classic liberal exercise, classic Democratic exercise, because it's the thing that we do within our own party. It's the thing that Democrats do. And you know, the Republican Party tends not to do that, tends not to engage in that type of what are other groups of people thinking. So it is something to keep in mind also that it, you know, it's a little one-sided when these types of exercises are attempted.
Now, these days, you can get practically anything on demand. Magazines, for instance, this podcast. And you can get stamps on demand. You don't have to go to the post office anymore to mail letters or packages. You can get postage on demand with stamps.com. With stamps.com, you can access all the amazing services of the post office. And let me stand for the post office, as I usually do. It is one of the best services that we take for granted that America offers when you think about it. It is cheap, it is reliable, and now it comes to you. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, using your own computer and printer, and the mail carrier just picks it up. There's no calling to get a pickup. There's no dropping off anywhere. Just click print mail, and you are done. I use stamps.com for my official business, which I do have. To be honest, there's not a ton of it, but I no longer have to make my schedule around the post office. The post office comes to me. So you want to try it out? You can. Use friends for this special offer. You get $55 of free postage, a digital scale, and a 4-week trial. Go to stamps.com. And before you do anything else, click on the radio microphone, which also could be a podcast microphone, at the top of the homepage and type in friends. That's right. Go to stamps.com. Go to the podcast microphone on the top of the homepage and type in friends. That's stamps.com and enter friends. Now, would you buy a t-shirt for $50 if you knew it only cost $7 to make? I wouldn't. And with Everlane, I don't have to, and neither do you. Everlane only makes premium essentials for men and women using the finest materials without traditional markups. And they tell you their real costs so you know you're never overpaying. They want you to know what you're paying for and why. They are radically transparent about every step of the process, from the materials they use to the ethical factories they work with. And because Everlane sells directly to you, the prices are 30 to 50% lower than traditional retailers. Everlane's clothes look better, cost less, last longer. Essentials like their Cotton Crew t-shirt are exactly what they should be. Simple, stylish, made from quality materials. Check out their Cashmere Crew. It's, for some reason, actually sometimes cashmere weather here in Minnesota sometimes. We're having a weird, weird summer. The 100% human box cut tee, the silk short sleeve square shirt, the high-rise skinny jean, the mid-rise jean, that is my favorite, and more. Everlane's timeless essentials are just what you're looking for. No frills, just quality. And right now, you can check out my personalized collection at everlane.com/friends. Plus, you'll get free shipping on your first order. I had a lot of fun putting this together, my personalized collection, at everlane.com/friends. Again, you will get free shipping on your first order. Everlane.com/friends.
So I just talked to Rick Wilson, and we ended in kind of this dark place because we were talking about how we're very lucky that we have a relatively stable time for our country in terms of, you know, civil society and economically. Like, you know, mm-hmm. there's not a huge social crisis. I mean, there's lots of problems, but we have a sort of functioning civil society, right? Mm-hmm. And so Trump can do stuff, but like we're on an everyday level, we are mostly attempting to get along with each other, you know, and like people go to work and school and all that. But if something were to happen where we had an economic crisis or a national security crisis, and that was destabilized, the kinds of shit that Trump could get away with would be pretty obscene.
There's some research in comparative politics, which looks at other countries, you know, the yeah. politics of other countries. And there's some research in that field which actually has shown that, you know, when you have racial, ethnic, and religious alignment politically, the chance of civil war increases substantially. And it's not assured, but one of the things that tends to make it a lot more likely is if you already have this situation and then there is an economic challenge or a crisis of leadership.
Yeah, that's yep.
Yeah.
we were basically, yes, that's sort of where we were going with it, was that we're in this very tenuous time in a way, you know, like if something went wrong, the way the Trump administration has kind of worked on our brains and the way we've sorted ourselves, we are in a place where a lot of violence could happen. That's what we were talking about.
Yeah. No, it's not. And we're not unique in the world.
Right. Know, exactly. We've seen this happen in other countries. It would not. And, you know, when I theorize this and when Rick and I were theorizing it, we weren't talking about it like out of our ass. Like, I mean, you can look at other collapsed countries and this is what happens.
Yeah.
And where yeah. I decided to take it after we got to this very depressing place is something actually I think you're sort of been talking around too, which is that what can I as a person do about it? You know, what can my listeners do about this? We talked about, mm-hmm. well, you know, go to your neighbor's yard sale, like volunteer, you know, go across town and go to a restaurant there, like be in your community. And I actually do some volunteer work that's non-political. And I think that if you have the time and energy, I think that's actually a great place to kind of do your part to keep civil war from coming.
Yeah.
It sounds like this research sort of backs this up.
It does. It would be the idea is to actually, you probably have to like leave your community, you know, you
All
have
right.
to go to a different community, and work there, you know, volunteer there.
Right.
Because our communities have become pretty, politically isolated also. So yeah, it would be make social ties with people who are not politically like you and are not socially like you. I mean, the one issue with that advice is that I strongly recommend it for white people.
Yes.
But for, you know, anybody who feels like they're going to be in danger by walking into a different community, that's not as easy to do.
I would right? say then so, do work in your own community if that's where you feel safe. But I also...
Right.
I mean, I guess part of my thinking, I think that's a really wonderful distinction. I totally agree with it. You're totally right. And it's white people that need to work on their ability to work with other people. People who are marginalized have to work with people like who are different than them most of the time, you know?
Right.
So like they don't need to go outside their community to know what it's like to deal with a white person, right? Like they're having to kind of think about white people and what white people want and what white people need all the time. Or straight
yeah.
or cis or, you know, all those things. I do think there's something of value to just having non-political life in your community. like even if it is just in your community, like
absolutely
knowing how to talk to someone, knowing people's names, even if it's like just a little bit outside. And I guess when I say your community, I'm thinking like your city, you know, and not your neighborhood, mm-hmm. like just connecting is important. Authoritarianism and civil war and violence happen when people are isolated and scared. Yep. So
when they feel afraid of each other, when they feel threatened by each other.
Yeah.
And when they feel like if the other guy wins, then I lose.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a real feeling that's out there, and it's sort of this palpable feeling that's out there right now that if, you know, if you do better, then I do worse.
Yeah.
And that's a root of a lot of this. And you know, individually going and making sure that your social world is slightly more diverse politically is probably helpful. But it, you know, at the same time, everybody has to do that.
Yeah. And they're right. And there's only one group of us that's really more primed for it.
And that's the problem is one group of people is practiced and has been doing it. And the other group of people doesn't have an interest in doing it or feel that they have any obligation to. So that I think is one of the big challenges is actually really reaching out to people who are in really isolated and traditionally high status groups. And I'm not saying that they're like, you know, currently wealthy people. It's just the traditionally high status groups or higher status. That I think is our real challenge because if you're not interested in reaching out to people outside of your racial or religious or partisan group, then that's the problem, right? If you have absolutely no desire to do that and you have absolutely no interest in trying, that's where I think we're going to come across, possibilities of violence, possibilities of conflict.
Yeah. I actually think of like my own individual actions in that regard that there's something to be said for being the liberal person in a group of conservatives, you know, like that's a kind of outreach to do a non-political kind of mm-hmm. have a non-political actions and activities and service work. For me personally, like that's sort of what I like try to do with my family, my in-laws.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. To humanize the other side.
Yeah. Is like just try to live my values in front of them. You know, so that their stereotype of what a social justice warrior is and does and believes, like I want to be the thing that they know isn't, you know, I want to help break up that stereotype for them.
Right. And you're not a monster. And you know, some of the work I'm doing now is actually looking at partisan dehumanization. And there are, you know, there are Americans who think of the other side as animals. They will say they're animals.
Yeah.
It's not huge numbers, you know, it's like 5%, 10%, but that's still millions of people.
Yeah.
And it's just, we measured that in 2017. And that's where it gets really dangerous, right? Is if you think of someone as so different from you that they're not human, then we actually start seeing people treating each other, in violent ways. But you know, and the question is, you know, do you, what is it that makes you not want to make a cake for another person, right? Is that person somehow less than human to you, right? To kind of bring it back to the first question, you know, is there something about that person that is, you know, less than a fully acceptable human being? And if that is in there somewhere, right, the idea that this person is a flawed human being, there's something wrong with them as a person, then that's, you know, that's the type of thing that really divides people.
Yeah. And like I said, sort of when I talk to my co-religionists about this, I get really frustrated. because there's a whole lot of stuff in my version of the Bible that talks about the humanity of others and being of service to others, and that to the extent, you know, someone is fallen, well, we're all fallen, you know. So I don't get it. I mean, I've asked conservative Christians 1,000 times to show me where it is I'm going to go to hell if I make a cake for a gay person.
Right.
Because it's not in there. I swear it's not in there.
Right, right.
There is,
would you make a cake for a, for a criminal that was in jail?
Would you make a cake for
probably
a leper or a whore?
You know,
you know, the people that,
right, right. Would
that Jesus hung out with, you know.
Yeah.
Like, so he,
I think it's a good question to say, like, would you make a cake for a criminal? And if so, then, you know, that's someone who didn't follow your rules.
Yeah. And you're right, because the one thing, there is a verse that I'm blanking on the exact verse, but there is a verse that talks about you not basically abetting sin, you know, not allowing sin to happen, not being a part of it. But, you know, like, that's, you're hanging a lot on that idea. And there's a whole lot of evidence on the other side. There's a whole lot of other stuff on the side of, you know, washing their feet, not just baking a cake, but, you know.
Right.
And
kind of, like I said, it's there's a lot going on behind the psychological scenes there. You know, if you're resting a whole lot on one sentence, then
maybe there's something
I'll
else going on.
I'll leave you with one quick story.
Okay.
This is an experiment that was done in 2003. Essentially, political psychologist Jeffrey Cohen asked people to write down like what their welfare positions were. And then he had a different group of people come back, and for half of them, he assigned them. He said, okay, this is the Democrats' welfare position, and this is the Republicans' welfare position. And the other half, he switched it. And then he asked them, what's your position on welfare? And they all chose the one that matched their party, regardless. Mm-hmm. And then he said, did your party have any effect on your attitude about this policy? And everyone said no. And then he said, okay, I'm going to ask you to write a letter to the editor of the newspaper. And I want you to know that your congressperson reads these, so this could actually have an effect on policy. So I want you to write a letter to the editor explaining the reasons that you hold this position. And people wrote tons of reasons that they held that position that they were just experimentally induced to hold. Like many reasons, they constructed them on the spot in order to defend the position that they had been told that their party held. So we can think that we have really good reasons behind the things that we say, but we are also very powerfully affected by our social cues, whether we know it or not, and to a degree that we actually probably really don't even know.
Mm. Well, I appreciate you coming on. I unfortunately have to say goodbye. But fascinating book, Uncivil Agreement: How Politics Became Our Identity. Apparently, you also write op-eds, so people should look out for those. And I am very interested to hear more about your further research. And definitely, we'll have to have you back. This is, I think, really vital stuff.
Great.
For what it's worth, I do think that there are conservatives and Republicans that are struggling a little bit with this, but they are not primed to do so. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
That's sort of the distinction you're talking about.
Yeah, you have to want. You have to be really motivated to.
Yeah.
To do it.
Yep. Anyway, thank you so much. I'm sure we'll speak again.
Thank you very much for having me. This was fun.
And that is it for today's show. Next week is going to be a little bit different because of the holiday in the middle of everything. It's going to be a show with frequently asked questions. And I should be clear, these are questions both that come via the email, the show's email, with friendslikepod@gmail.com, and questions that I just kind of get. A lot of them have to do with what am I actually trying to accomplish. It is a great opportunity for me to think about what I'm actually trying to accomplish. Thanks everyone who's been writing in general. We're finally catching up on the backlog of listener mail. Feel free to add to it if you want, again, with friendslikepod@gmail.com. Please don't just rate and review our show, by the way. Rate and review Erin Ryan's new show and, you know, download that thing too. It's really funny. She's really great. It's called Hysteria. It's a wonderful addition to the Crooked Media lineup. And just always, please, take care of yourself. And we'll see you next week.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.